lonely vegetarian sweet. You walk your feet like a maid Marian, having fun like a seminarian await. You say you're a happy Unitarian, laughing in the wind like an old Bulgarian. Hey, by the way, are you a librarian? Oh, how sweet.
Yes, I am a librarian. And my sister is also a librarian, and so is my friend and colleague, Maria. And the three of us are here today to bring you a very special treat, an interview with Megan Whelan Turner. Megan was amazingly generous with her time today, and for that reason, we're going to be splitting this podcast in two. There's actually going to be two podcasts featuring Megan, and this is then the first of two. And the second one will appear after Christmas. For those of you who don't know her, Megan is an award-winning author, and her most famous works are the really gripping Queen's Thief series, as well as a number of really wonderful short stories. So we hope you enjoy this interview, and without further ado, let's get going.
Hello.
Hi, Megan. Is this
Megan? Hi.
Yeah, this is Deirdre from the Mount Kisco Library.
Hi, and this is Maria.
Great!
And Mary, a teen librarian from the North Castle Library in Armonk. I'm Deirdre's sister.
Yeah, so we're so happy to be talking to you.
Well, thank you so much for having me talk. I admit I'm supposed to be proofreading my galleys right now, so this is a nice excuse to take a break.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're happy to provide you with a little recreation.
Yeah, some procrastinating time.
Yes. Perfect procrastinating time.
My first question is that we would love your pronunciation of all the names. And we understand that, you know, different people can pronounce them differently. We all do, actually. But we all know who we're talking about when we're talking about your wonderful books. So would that be okay? Would you be willing to pronounce everyone's names for us?
Sure. Tell me first, how do you pronounce the main character in the thief's name?
Oh, I pronounce it Eugenides.
So do I.
I do too, but I go a bit more like Eugene. Eugenides.
I've actually heard a number of different pronunciations of the character's names. And my policy is that everybody gets to say the names any way they want and that there isn't any one right way to say them. I say Eugenides.
Okay, thanks.
And the Magus has a hard T in the middle.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
And in spite of the fact that there's been a vowel shift and the people in the mountain country don't speak with the same accent as the people in the lowlands, I still pronounce the queen of the mountain country's name as Edis, not Edis. When I'm looking at the story and when I'm thinking about the story in my head, she's Edis.
Ah, interesting. When I lengthened the vowel, I said Edis instead of Edith. Too much linguistics. I don't know.
there's no such thing as too much linguistics.
That's funny.
I have a question about Sunis. I pronounce it Sunis, but I've heard people pronounce it Saunus. How do you pronounce that particular country?
I say Sunis. Any other one?
Atolia accented on the second syllable?
Yes, I say Atolia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we're guessing Sophos is right?
Yes, Sophos.
And we can't ask about any characters in the new book yet, so we'll have to wait on that.
No, please don't. I was going to ask you, though, about how you feel, for the purposes of this discussion, about spoilers.
Oh.
Are you assuming that the people that will be listening to this podcast have read The Thief or not read The Thief or read The Queen of Atolia and The King of Atolia or not?
Hmm. Well, I was thinking we'll probably...
If you want to have a conversation free of spoilers, I think it would mean that you'll have to edit a lot more errs and ums out of your podcast as I try to think my way around blurting out spoilers.
Right. Okay, we're definitely not going to spoil the fourth book at all.
Okay.
We might mention some points in the first three books, though. I'm thinking that my plan was to be as spoiler-free as possible, but not to worry about it too much, because I think a little bit of information might intrigue those who haven't read it yet. Do you agree?
Okay.
So we weren't
that sounds good to me, yes.
Spoilerish and awful, but
and that's completely spoiler free either. That would make it hard, I think, for us.
I think we might end up biting our tongues for 15 minutes on tape.
Yeah. Which would be painful and dreadful, and why do it? Yeah.
Okay, so we'll try to avoid big spoilers, but we might let a few small spoilers slip out.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. Okay, who gets the next question?
This is actually one of Maria's as well as one of mine, but I have been very curious for some time about how old Jen is supposed to be in the first book, and what is the rough timeline for the four books altogether? About how many years are we covering here?
Well, here we're bumping right into, almost right away, the one thing that I mentioned to Deirdre in the email exchange that we had.
Oh, okay.
And that is that the answer to a lot of these questions that people have asked me along these lines is I'm not telling. I feel very strongly that the books need to stand on their own.
Uh-huh.
And that it's sort of cheating if an author explains her book or fills in missing parts of her story in a sort of back channel way. And I think that if you read the books carefully, you can get a pretty good idea of how old Jen is.
And you can get
a pretty good idea of how old other characters are. But the thing is that becomes more clear as you continue reading the books.
Yes.
It's pretty fluid still in The Thief, exactly how old Jen is. And that's not by accident.
Right.
What I find that's really amusing is that people's idea of how old Jen is varies depending on their own age.
Oh.
So the 13-year-olds think he's 13.
Huh.
And the 16-year-olds tend to think that he's 16 or 17.
Uh-huh.
And the 47-year-olds think that he must be at least 20, maybe 25.
Oh,
really? Because I didn't think that. I thought he was probably about 14.
Okay. Well,
but as far as The Thief goes, I really like to leave it up to the reader.
Right.
Yeah.
To imagine him as they choose. Now, as I said, as you go further in the book, the age of the characters sort of becomes more clearly revealed. But still, if you don't want to believe that, you don't have to. If you want to go through the whole book believing, you know, that he's 13 and The Thief, me standing here outside of the book and saying definitely how old he is kind of unfair. I think that people who want to imagine him as they choose, there's no reason for me to nail it down outside of the book. There's information in the book if you read it carefully. But if you choose to ignore that, I think that's your business, and you can imagine him a variety of ages.
Right. For instance, I was kind of thinking the Army enrollment papers, and we're not going to mention which book or anything about it, but certain civilizations like Sparta did those things really, really young, whereas others like ours do them older. So,
Yeah. Yeah, I think it would be a mistake to think that parallels our world.
Right.
I think that this world that they live in isn't our world in so many ways that it can be taken as part of this world that things like that happen at a younger age than they would happen here.
Okay. And
so not just in Sparta, but in what we know of, say, the British Isles, and a lot of warring tribal nation-state civilizations move their young men into combat roles very young.
Yeah, definitely. Which is sad, but interesting.
Okay.
And I love your answer, I have to say, Megan. It just confirms you in my mind as a writer of great integrity.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say as truly uncooperative.
No, no, not at all. I mean, here you are talking to us, and we're thrilled because.
Yes, and the answer is I'm not telling. Yeah, how cooperative is that? Ask me more questions that I'm not going to answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. I was about to do that because we want to know the Magus' actual name. Because
not telling.
I know you're not.
But we find it very interesting that almost all of the main characters call him the Magus, even though he might not be their Magus.
Right.
He's just known all around the then known world for wisdom, I guess.
Well, he's known by his title, mm-hmm. and that is not unusual in this world.
Yeah.
If you notice, Jen very, very rarely uses the first name of the queens. He always calls them by their title.
Yes.
He might say, my cousin who is Edis.
Right.
Or my wife who is Atolia. But these people are known by their titles.
Yeah.
And it's only in very, very, very personal circumstances that you would have them calling each other by their names. They're not their names anymore, really. They are their titles.
I'm going to throw this one out there, and you might not answer it either, but since we're on the topic of names, I always love to ask authors how they choose names for their characters. How do you choose the names for your characters? Some authors say that they look through baby name books, and I know this probably wouldn't apply in your situation, you know, but do you have, like, favorite sources that you go to for names, or make them up?
The starting place for choosing the names for these stories is that more? It was more important what they did not sound like than what they did sound like.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are familiar with the game Dungeons and Dragons, and a lot of people know characters in books by Tolkien, and right. when they go to make up their names for their Dungeons and Dragons games, lots of times they come out looking like names you might have run across from Tolkien, like Galadriel.
Yeah.
If you look at a lot of American fantasy, the names are sort of Tolkien-esque, and what they really are in that case is based on the construction patterns of names from the myths and the stories of the British Isles.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Those names with lots of flowy L's in them and R's and A's, like Efluerion, those are names that come out of Western European naming traditions. Hmm. And I didn't want to use them. I didn't want to have names that sounded Western European and British Isles and even Norse. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for some other naming conventions to use. I was also looking, before I wrote the story, I was looking for the landscape that I wanted to set it in. And when I settled on the Mediterranean Greek landscape, it also supplied the naming conventions as well. So the names aren't Greek, but they use a lot of the naming conventions of Greek, the endings in IUS or EUS and IA and that sort of thing. And those are the techniques that I use maybe to build a name, but sometimes the names come out of really specific words I have in mind for a character. And so I take a word that I think is interesting, or I take a name that I think is interesting and use these naming conventions and come up with a name that will go into the book. Sometimes they're very close to Greek names, and sometimes they're further off and very bizarre. So Hephaestia, for instance, is just a feminization of Hephaestus.
Hephaestus, yeah.
Who, uh-huh. Right. And that's what I've done with a number of names. And Eugenides comes from the root Greek word for well-born.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. That I knew.
Right. Which gave us the name Eugene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I could have named my main character Eugene, but I liked Eugenides better.
Yeah. Eugene, it would remind me too much of that song. Hey, Eugene, do you remember me? Anyway.
your favorite salsa dancer you had ever come across in New York City? Eugene.
And I was just wondering, as a beginning writer, what your process is, because your plots are so extremely well constructed. I just can't imagine that you have all of this in your head. Do you actually outline it all, though, beforehand in order to get these very convoluted plots, or do you retrofit things?
Actually, I think that's related to a question I was going to ask you, Megan, because, as you know, I wrote to you about some of your short stories, and I was struck particularly by, in Aunt Charlotte and the NGA portraits, how the characters piece puzzles together. And that made me think of another one of my favorite writers, Muriel Spark, who saw herself mainly as a poet and thought that to be a poet, you really need to know how to do puzzles. And I wondered if you see yourself as kind of a puzzle master to craft these intricate plots.
Sometimes I do. And to answer Mary's question, the first stage of my storytelling is usually to tell the story out loud. Hmm. And when I'm telling the story out loud, the oral storytelling is very different from the written storytelling. There are a lot of things that you can convey with a hand wave when you're telling the story out loud. And then when you go to write those things down, you need to fill in all of the detail. But the first time I sit down and am writing a story, I don't outline it, but I do sketch it. So I will sketch out a rough draft that will, in most cases, be a half as long or a third as long as the final version. It's much too long and has too many details in it, I think, to call it an outline. But it isn't exactly a rough draft yet because there's still a lot of hand-waving in it. So, you know, just a simple note that they travel for this period of time. And then I'll go back later and I will write out all of those scenes. And, yeah, sometimes I do feel like I have little pieces of a puzzle and I need to fit them in very, very carefully. But I also feel sometimes as if I'm building a bridge from the beginning to the end, and the story, the bridge has to be strong enough to hold up the story. And so each little detail, did you guys ever get that assignment where you were supposed to build a bridge out of toothpicks in your physics class? you can only use toothpicks, right? Yeah. You toothpicks and glue, and everybody builds a bridge, and then you keep putting more weight on it until your bridge crashes to the ground and you've tested it. Writing a story is a little bit like that, too. You only have little tiny bits, and you keep gluing them into the bridge, making it stronger and stronger and stronger until you have something that's strong enough that it'll carry the whole story. So sometimes writing is like that, and sometimes it's more like you wake up in the morning and you think, oh, I have this little teeny tiny piece of a puzzle, and it's blue and it's green, and I know there has to be some place in that story I can fit it in. And so you go looking for a hole where you can plug in that little factor, that little detail or something. Other times you think you've got the whole puzzle there and it's all smooth, but you get the one more piece and you end up unpicking your entire puzzle and squeezing in that little spot and then filling everything back in. And in that case, it's a little bit more like pinching up the clay and then smoothing it down again.
Well, I think we all agree that your stories are very character-driven, which is one reason why we love them. Have you ever found your characters changing on you as you have been writing them?
You mean they weren't the person that I thought that they were when I started the story?
Absolutely. Yeah, because you do that to your readers a little bit. They change as you read them, so we were just wondering if they also changed as you were writing them.
You know, it's hard to say because they start out so amorphous and vague and fluid in the beginning when I'm making up these stories. They settle like sediment in the bottom of a glass, and they form up gradually. But once I am ready to write a story and start at the beginning and run through to the end, no, I pretty much know who everybody is. And they don't change into different people then. But as I'm constructing the story, exactly who they are isn't at all set. It's a sort of gradual process where you get to know them better and better and better and better. And each new thing that you learn about them tells you who that character is in other ways. But each new thing fills in their character more deeply. I haven't run across anything where it changed their character. That's a tricky question. I might have to think about that one some more.
What's that?
Tricky, Mary. Okay, so I have a question that's sort of related to that question. And it's more, I guess, maybe about dialogue. I read this interview with J.K. Rowling once, and she said that in the course of writing her massively famous Harry Potter books, occasionally while she was writing dialogue, her characters would surprise her with what came out of their mouths. So I was just wondering, have your characters ever surprised you while you were writing them?
I'd have to say no, not so much. I don't know if that's because I'm approaching my characters in a very different way. I think it might just be that I'm not surprised by my characters because maybe I don't feel like I know them until later in the process.
Oh.
So as my characters are producing new dialogue or as I'm learning more about my characters, I'm not surprised because I'm not feeling like already as if I know them, as if they're set in stone.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think it may be that we're talking about apples and oranges here, that I'm not surprised by my characters because I don't feel like I know everything about them. So when something new comes up, I just think, there's something new.
Oh,
I don't think,
that's cool.
Gosh, who knew her favorite color was blue?
Majorly cool.
It's just one more detail to their character that I didn't know before, but now I do. You know, now that I think of it, it may also be because I think of my characters as being inconsistent in the way that real people are inconsistent. I think that if you're talking about a character and the character is two-dimensional in a story, there's a little bit of tension when you're writing characters, that if you actually made a person in your story behave just like a real person would, he would drive the reader crazy because none of his actions would be consistent. And people would say, that's perfectly ridiculous. Here you said he was a Republican, and then on Tuesday you had him vote as a Democrat. And if you go back through his backstory, here you can see all of these clearly Republican things that he said before, and here he's just being out of the blue and for no reason voting as a Republican. But that's the way real people actually behave.
Yeah.
They do things that are irrational. They turn left instead of turning right. They decide on Tuesday that they're not going to go to work the same way they've always gone to work. They're going to go to work a different way. If you put it into a book, it looks like the author is setting up bizarre coincidences in order to further her plot. And it looks bad.
Oh,
the truth
no,
is,
never.
People do that. People do that, though, all the time. In real life, people aren't consistent in their decisions. They're not consistent in their philosophy. They're not consistent in their morals. But when we put them into a book, we expect them to be consistent about all of those things. Or we point to that in the story and we say, that's a flaw. That character is inconsistent. But if we made all of our characters totally consistent in the story, they'd be two-dimensional, utterly predictable, and not terribly interesting. So my characters, for me, they're actually much more inconsistent in my head than they are when they're behaving in the story. And so when I run across things in my characters that are inconsistent, rather than saying that character is not who I expected her to be or not who I expected him to be, I just think in my head that that's one more detail to a realistic character. It may or may not make it into the story. But it doesn't mean that character has surprised me. It just means that, you know, that character's got this irrational quirk that makes them who they are.
Uh-huh. Megan, that's fascinating. And I wanted now to progress maybe from the characters to the entire world a little bit. And on behalf of some of the people from Sunnis, I was wondering how it is that two of your countries seem to be masculine, regardless of whether kings or queens are ruling them, whereas another one is feminine. So you have Sunnis and Edis, and Edis, although she's a queen, is called Edis and not Edia or... and then
or Adia or Edia.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
The answer is not telling.
Okay. Because I do have a theory about that myself, but I guess maybe I'll keep it to myself too. So.
Right. You can have your theory.
Yeah.
Anybody who wants can have their theory, but that's one of those things that I don't think I can talk about outside of the book.
Right.
The book really has to stand on its own, and if people want to interpret it, they can. If they just want to skip over it, they can do that too. But unless at some point later in the book I decide to stick that information in, I don't think I'm going to give that information out.
Okay, very good. So,
you know, as people, we're very inconsistent about our actions and our morals and our philosophy, and I might change my mind on that, but I do sort of feel like I'm a little unsettled still about how much authors should talk about their books.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think the book should stand on their own. I don't think the author should explain their books. I think that if you feel something was unclear in the story, that it would be cheating for me to say, oh, no, this is what I meant by that. I didn't really mean X. I really meant Y. If I really meant why, I should have made it clear in the story. And if I didn't make it clear in the story, I can't go rewriting history and retconning it after the thing is written and printed.
Right.
On the other hand, I know that I have an awful lot more information about the world and about the characters in my head than will ever make it onto a page.
Right.
And I'm not entirely sure what to do with all of that information, because people ask questions and there's this temptation to answer them and say, oh, no, what you don't know about the captain of the guard is blah, and then rattle out the entire backstory. But I think I just better bite my tongue.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, we're going to end this half of the podcast right there. In the second half, we will feature Megan again, and she will be disclosing all sorts of interesting information about animals and cooking and food, including microwaves and things called burritos, and any number of interesting facts about her wonderful books and characters. So please do stay tuned for the next episode with Megan, which will be happening after Christmas. In the new year, we will be featuring our Feast of Awesome authors, the debutantes of 2009. Continue talking with us, and our first interview will be with Carrie Ryan, author of The Forest of Hands and Teeth, whose next book, The Dead Tossed Waves, will be appearing this coming year. And we have a number of fascinating authors after her, like Nisha Memminger and Sarah McLean, and any number of really fascinating people, so you don't want to miss it. If you have any suggestions for us or questions, you can contact us at the Mount Kisco Library. That's Mount KISCO Library in Northern Westchester, New York. And we are easily found on the internet. You can also give us a call at 914-666-8041. And if you like this podcast, please vote for us in Podcast Alley. We'd love to know what you think. And remember, if you want to get any of Megan's books or any other books or any information, there's one place you can go. That's right. Your public library.
It's a lot of fun. You can learn a lot about the world that we live in the public library. The library, the library. It's a place where books are free. The library, the library. It's a lot better than watching TV. Sections about almost everything. You'll always find something you're interested in. Place tectonics or